take a network break, grab some virtual donuts, and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. Last week was a super extra long episode. I think this week might be a little shorter, so, you know, it all balances out.
Yeah, well, we do try to make sure the shows are as short as possible. And when we have a little bit, not much to say, we do try and keep the shows short. So you'll see some shows are down at the 30 minutes and longer shows at 45. So we generally try not to talk just for the sake of it.
Yeah, although last week hit an hour, which is unusual. But anyway, let's move on so we can keep this short. Today's show is sponsored in part by HexaBuild. Started by IPv6 experts to drive worldwide adoption of IPv6, HexaBuild is the IPv6 training, education, and consulting company. If your projects include cloud, IoT, security, or networking, you need IPv6. And HexaBuild is here to help you deploy and manage it successfully. Head over to hexabuild.io to learn more. That's hexabuild.io. And full disclosure, the folks at HexaBuild also do the IPv6 Buzz podcast here on the Packet Pushers Network.
That's pretty fantastic. We should mention that the last or second to last podcast actually includes an interview with Vint Cerf. Yes, that Vint Cerf, the man who invented most of the internet. It's a wonderful episode. And there's some good conversation in there around. I think one of the things that I took away was his sense of regret about the mistakes that he made 30 years later. And he's very open about it. But he said, you know, I just couldn't make sense of them. He said, I couldn't imagine that this is what would happen. And looking back, he says, I wish we could have done something differently. But, you know, that's what it is. So it was a great conversation.
Interesting.
Very, very natural.
Yeah.
You
got to be a guest on that show to hang out with Mr. Cerf and the rest of the IPv6 crew.
Yes, which was pretty great. It was great of them to invite me along as a temporary co-host. I got to ask a question about Mr. Cerf think that the internet would fragment, and he said yes. So just in case you think I'm the only rat bag about that, then the answer is no.
Okay.
I know we do talk about it.
Well, there you go. All right, so that's IPv6 Buzz. Go check it out, packetpushers.net. Stay tuned after the news. We've got a Tech Bytes conversation where we talk with a Fortinet SD-WAN customer, PM Pediatrics, about their SD-WAN deployment, including enabling their move off of MPLS and SD-WAN's impact on critical voice services.
Health provider running SD-WAN.
Yes, healthcare provider.
And quite got a lot of praise for the Fortinet SD-WAN solution for his situation.
All right, before we jump into the news, we got a couple of FUs or follow-ups. First, this one is prompted by our discussion of NVIDIA and the RISC microprocessor architecture.
Yeah, I kept calling it RISC-V because that's what I thought it was called. Turns out it's called RISC-V.
There you go.
as somebody wrote in, I don't have a name, but thank you very much for writing in. He said, this falls in the picky category, but RISC-V is pronounced RISC-V. This is because it is the fifth reduced instruction set computer developed at Berkeley and Stanford universities, I assume, in the U.S.
And let me just, before you get another FU, it's Berkeley.
Berkeley? That must be some foreign spelling of the word Berkeley.
No, but go ahead.
apparently I also suggested that it was developed by IBM. Nope, I was getting confused with the Power architecture, the Power CPU architecture they developed. The RISC architecture is entirely separate. However, IBM did recently open up the Power architecture to anybody. But the RISC-V architecture was developed for instructional purposes and became popular because it was freely licensed. And he also agrees with me that it'll probably become the dominant architecture in IT over time, just because of licensing. Like, we're seeing ARM start to assert stronger licensing claims over its products, and I think that will ultimately squeeze ARM out. They will, especially if a company like NVIDIA, we talked last week about NVIDIA potentially buying ARM. We know that companies like Qualcomm, Broadcom, and NVIDIA are very aggressive about maintaining ownership and maximizing the revenue opportunity, and IoT makers don't really have an opportunity to share profits. So they're not making that much profit. So yes, the RISC-V, I'll get it right this time, is likely to be the success factor going forward. Yep.
RISC-V, I got to sink that into my brain. RISC-V,
RISC-V. I've never heard anybody saying it. I'm so used to like iOS 10, you know, iOS X, blah, 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 Mac OS X. So it just got into the Roman numerals, I guess.
All right, one more FU from our Cumulus Broadcom conversation from episode 302 regarding the capability of Mellanox's Spectrum ASIC compared to Broadcom's Trident 3.
Somebody from Cumulus got in touch with me and said, from a Cumulus perspective, we have all the same L2 features for both Trident 3 and Spectrum. Most importantly, Spectrum has a highly flexible pipeline if they needed to do any sort of multi-lookup thing. So maybe that's because of I had a perception from a couple of years ago where the Mellanox's MXOS, which is their own in-house operating system, really wasn't able to do a lot of this stuff, didn't have a lot of layer 2 features, and it might not have been limited by the ASIC, it might have just been limited by their operating system. But so I take that back. Cumulus Linux apparently has all the same L2 features that you would expect, whether it's running on a Broadcom Trident 3 or a Spectrum. Just note that it says Trident 3 here, but, you know, maybe some of the early ASICs aren't quite the same, but whatever. The point is that modern Broadcoms and Mellanox's Spectrums will have the L2 features that you need. Last week, I made a mistake when we were talking about the Juniper QFX 5130 switch, and I attempted to make the point quite falsely that it is DC powered only. That is, it's only powered on the 48 volt DC. That is not correct. The switch model comes with both redundant AC and DC power options in the portfolio. So the QFX 5130 is one of the first switches to come to market based around the Broadcom Trident 4 chipset. Obviously, it's got some good programmability and Junos can use that. And it's got 32 ports of 400 gig. And the choice of AC and DC power supplies means, as I alluded to last week, that it works for both service providers and enterprises. Service providers often run 48 volt DC circuits inside of their edges or their POPs or whatever you want to call them. And I apologize unreservedly for the error. I'm not at all sure how I made this mistake and how I got this idea, so I can only apologize a lot.
Thank you for the follow-up. We really appreciate it. Comments, corrections are welcome. If you want to follow up on anything that happens on today's show, head on over to packetpushers.net/FU. All right, let's do some news. Ericsson has acquired Cradlepoint for $1.1 billion. Cradlepoint provides wireless WAN services using LTE and 5G for use cases like connecting branch offices, field sites, delivery vehicles, and IoT.
Yeah, this is a very interesting acquisition. I think this is Ericsson getting an SD-WAN play, getting a product that it can turn into an SD-WAN and it can start to sell as an extension. So and they actually allude to this in the press release that they published on Ericsson.com, where they say the transaction will close before the end of 2020, which is a pretty quick acquisition. They're buying it from cash in hand. So none of this shares or any of that's just like, here's the money, get over here. So,
and welcome aboard.
Welcome aboard. Yeah, I don't expect it'll go through any competitive issues or special, you know, foreign interest review boards or any of that sort of stuff. So most likely it will go straight through and become part of it. I basically see this as Ericsson getting an SD-WAN strategy that makes sense for them. That is, a lot of where Cradlepoint came from in the early days was that it was a 4G edge technology. So you would buy a little box the size of half the size of a paperback novel, and it had 4G paddles and it did Wi-Fi and Ethernet out the other side. So basically used the mobile network as a back end. And they continued to iterate over that product over time and enhance it and turn it much more into an SD-WAN. So now you can have LAN side as well as mobile in the box, and it does local Wi-Fi. So very, very SD-WAN, but with a particular focus around the mobile phone technology, the mobile backbone, and that, of course, is exactly what Ericsson's about. So I imagine that Ericsson is now going to its customers saying, we've got an SD-WAN strategy that uses your 5G for broadband. You know, you could use this for business or some such silliness, and we'll see how that goes. But that makes sense, I think. Don't you? What do you think?
Yeah, my original impression of Cradlepoint was like for, you know, say like a gas station where you couldn't pull fiber to or something, it's out in the middle of nowhere, you could still get connectivity through a wireless connection, and Cradlepoint would have the ability to put multiple connections in there. So if one failed, you could switch to the other. So they can extend into SD-WAN. I agree. There's also, of course, mobile features like, you know, trucks, delivery trucks, IoT in remote locations that they can also play in. This is interesting to me. It's the first time I assumed Ericsson just made its living selling to carriers, but now they actually can sell to enterprises as well.
Yeah, I think they will. They've always done some. They used to have their own enterprise networking division for a while. They bought various companies over the years, but never really been able to get traction in the market. But I mostly see this as a product that they will sell through service providers to the enterprise. So I was at the Juniper Analyst Day this week, and they were talking very much about they're seeing Juniper products being actively sold by service providers to enterprise customers. So, you know, the managed services contracts and their service providers are taking over, say, customers' WANs or whatever. And Juniper's getting a resurgence as service providers take their products into customer sites. I think Ericsson wants to position itself for the same thing. A lot of the service providers know that their core bandwidth, you know, their core revenue operations are disappearing, and coming up with new business models is something. That's what I think this is headed to.
Right. And sort of on the back end, if they can encourage more enterprises to start using 5G for various use cases, then conceivably in the long run, that's also good for Ericsson if they can sell more 5G gear to carriers and telcos.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be big in the US. Because the 5G economics in the US are a bit weird because of the way the spectrum's allocated and the telcos run. They might be able to, but the point about having a 5G broadband solution is there's not much point in doing it in central New York, but not being able to do it, you know, out in the countryside sort of thing. You've got to have a consistent way of delivering a service to be able to market it, if that makes sense. And having different technologies in different places and offering different levels of services tends to end up with customers going like, but it works over here, but it doesn't work. You know, it's like, so we'll see how that pans out. Anyway, I think it's a great exit for Cradlepoint. They're a very good team. Lots of smart people over there. They've got $1 billion, so they've got unicorn status. Yay for them. Whoever their investors
put that horn
are,
on.
You know, once they can hit the $1 billion, they can all bang their chests and say how clever they are.
Yes, very good.
Good for them.
All right, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Moving on, HPE has officially closed its acquisition of Silver Peak. We talked about this many months ago, but it's now official. It's all done. They're a part of HPE, and Silver Peak provides SD-WAN services for those who don't know.
Yes, and as we can see more politics, I think we'll keep bringing this up, that not all deals close. And so when they close, we'll just make a point of mentioning them, and when they don't close, we'll also try and make a point of mentioning those going forward. But I think perhaps the more interesting part of this is that, you know, we've had Cisco Viptela, we've got VMware with VeloCloud, we've got Palo Alto with CloudGenix, and now HPE Aruba with Silver Peak. Of course, Juniper's got its own Contrail SD-WAN solution that it's put together. Fortinet developed its own. This kind of feels like it's the last major acquisition. Is there anybody else out there that sort of doesn't have an SD-WAN? Maybe Checkpoint, perhaps?
Arista. Arista needs an SD-WAN.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Arista might...
I mean, if they want to be in the enterprise, you're missing out if you're not an SD-WAN, if you want to be an enterprise player.
Yeah, I guess they'll have to buy somebody, because they don't have building that up from in-house. But then again, they've also got their own way of doing code. You know, they've got a fairly...
Right.
They have this approach to code must be done the right way. And I'm not sure that they would just buy anybody to buy have a product. I think they would try and buy something that they could build on top of. So historically, when they bought companies, they buy something that's either distressed or something that is small enough that they can take it in-house and then re-spin and retrain and re-pivot or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, but of the folks out there, I feel like Arista is the big legacy network folk. I mean, maybe Extreme, too, I guess. But they've been very busy digesting all of their acquisitions from the past few years. So.
Yeah, I think Extreme's problem is much more complicated in the sense that they've got all those business units all separate. They have to streamline them. And then they've been, you know, a lot of those businesses weren't, they were sort of subscale or sub-profitable. And a lot of them, they didn't pay a lot for them, you know, is one sense. But still, having to support five different product lines of the same thing, you know, like Avaya and, you know, Brocade and all the bits and pieces is a bit of a challenge.
Yes, although I will mention last week we talked about their new plan to do universal hardware that can run multiple network operating systems that are in their portfolio, so they are looking to address that. But in any case...
Yeah, it'll just take time for that to come through. Really will take time.
Yeah. But the top line, Silver Peak is officially now part of HPE. It's going to be under the Aruba business unit. Aruba does wireless and WAN networking.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Aruba
and campus,
is a networking brand. Yep. HPE continues to keep the Aruba brand at arm's length. So it'll probably become Aruba Silver Peak. So not a bad thing.
Okay.
The Silver Peak brand did pretty well. Obviously, Silver Peak's been a major sponsor of the podcast over the last 3 or 4 years. But I do feel that Silver Peak was a really substantial player. And obviously, the pivot around from WAN acceleration to SD-WAN, they really showed how that could be done. properly.
Yep, pivoted hard, pivoted fast, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, they turned it well. All right, moving on. Kentik is adding synthetic monitoring for its visibility platform.
Yeah, Kentik, also a sponsor of the show, but they're mainly were known for their flow analytics at scale. So they'll be able to collect all of your flow data. You send it, then they'll take it to the cloud and analyze it and then present back to you a range of intelligence and visibility into what's going on. They started with visibility, moved into analytics so that they could say, here's what's happening. And then they moved into, we can tell you about what's happening on your network. And Avi did talk to me a year or two ago saying synthetic monitoring, there's a lot of interest amongst customers to get something into the synthetic monitoring space. So must have finally sort of given in to customer demand.
That's Avi Friedman. He's the founder of Kentik, not Avi, the company acquired by VMware.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting to me because synthetic monitoring is kind of having a return to its time in the sun. So we talked this week to Cinefar. We published a sponsor podcast with them. And they were talking about how they're using a combination of deep packet inspection, synthetic monitoring to get deep visibility into the network and independent of the underlay. So it runs at the edge, if that makes sense. And then we had a car show, I think I want to say 3 or 4 weeks ago with NetMotion Software talking about doing something similar, but they were actually using mobile agents to generate the visibility data and so forth.
Right, and AppNeta also does synthetic transactions.
That's right, and it's this, you know, I keep talking about how visibility and analytics is definitely the 2020 emerging trend. But I mean, it was like a decade ago, synthetics was really all the rage, and we saw a lot of people, you know, promoting the idea of synthetics. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't get these cheap boxes that you could just lit around the place like candy bars, which is one of the things that enabled the market today. And the challenge was, 10 or 15 years ago, what runs the synthetic tests? And we couldn't get them onto routers because they were proprietary and closed and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that there are now so many applications being used by organizations that IT doesn't have any control over at all, SaaS applications, that when you're trying to do mean time to innocence for some kind of problem, a synthetic transaction can help you figure out, at least let you eliminate the network as an issue.
Yes, and I think the synthetic transactions are way more important than most people understand. In my point of view, I think it's really important that you get to the point where you're able to do tests out of band. This is what a lot of people don't understand, is that you need to be able to, just because you've got analytic data, so you've, in the case of Kentik, you're exporting flow records, storing them at scale because you get a lot, just handling flow data is very difficult, and then turning that into useful information with analytics. It still doesn't give you the next depth of getting deeper visibility into what's actually happening. And this is where synthetics is useful. You go from collecting the data, analyzing the data, doing analytics on the data, and then what do? You go like, oh, I can see that it's running slow at this location. And then you want to say, well, is it fixed or can I do something? Can I get more information? And synthetics is the natural next step. So that's why I see this as being having a resurgence now, is because we've got the foundation that changes that market around. At least that's how I think about it.
Yep. Well, welcome, Kentik, to the synthetic monitoring family.
Yes.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Hexabuild. They help organizations successfully adopt IPv6 through comprehensive training and education. If your company's using AWS to develop mobile apps, or you're dealing with managing networks for mergers and acquisitions, or IPv6 may be a blind spot in your organization's landscape. If you're struggling to make do with an ever-dwindling supply of IPv4 or private IPv4 addresses, you need a solid plan for IPv6 adoption, and Hexabuild can help you with training and consulting. Visit hexabuild.io, click on the training link to find out how Hexabuild can help. They can educate and train your team on IPv6. They provide professional services and consulting to help you succeed with your IPv6 adoption. They do assessments, audits, workshops, address planning and acquisition, design work and labs, all to help your team effectively learn and use IPv6. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can get a 10% discount on any training plus some IPv6 stickers if you go to training.hexabuild.io and use the discount code Packet Pushers, all one word. You'll get a 10% discount. That's training.hexabuild.io, and use the discount code Packet Pushers for a 10% discount.
Yeah, and they sure know a lot about it. And I can tell you from talking with the Hexabuild team over on the IPv6 Buzz podcast, they know a lot about this. They've done big projects with this IPv6 at scale, and they really know their stuff. So I'll get a little bit of an extra endorsement there from me for what it's worth. I think they've already proven themselves in the podcast alone, but you know, there you go.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if you want to get a sense of their depth of knowledge, you can do that for free by checking out the podcast. It's as a way to vet them. All right, moving on. Barracuda Networks, they're extending a partnership with Microsoft Azure that now includes a remote access service. Customers can deploy Barracuda's Cloud Gen WAN gateways in Azure VWAN and then use them essentially as VPN gateways. So the idea is that your remote users can be authenticated via Azure Active Directory. Traffic will then run into Microsoft's backbone to other VWAN hubs if you want that, or directed to third-party SaaS apps.
Yeah, this probably a little bit late in a sense. So many people have moved to the cloud. Remote desktops, particularly in Azure, has been a real issue. And Barracuda is obviously adapting their product to be able to catch up and offer people a VPN gateway so that they can access their resources that are being stored in Azure using the Azure VWAN technology. So this allows you to get the integrate with the Azure for the authentication and the deployment, but also to get the VPN out for the applications that don't actually use TLS, for example, or SSL, as I understand it. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. So, yeah, you can jump into applications hosted on Microsoft, but it will also direct you to other applications, whether they're in a data center or software as a service. So it does act as a straight VPN gateway, but it just happens to be hosted in VWAN.
I love the press release. It always talks – somehow every press release say they are the first virtual WAN partner to bring They must be like the 50th virtual WAN partner that Azure's got or something. Like, it seems like we get a press release every week about this. But every week they claim to be the first virtual WAN partner to bring. Really, marketing people should get better at this.
They should. By this time, they should, yes.
Really, they should, yeah.
But in any case, if you're looking for a remote access solution, if you're into Azure, you've already got your folks in Azure AD, this may be something worth looking at. We've got links in the show notes if you want more. Moving on, Cisco may be on a trade blacklist being prepared by the Chinese government to block access to the Chinese market. This is according to a story in the Wall Street Journal.
The only reason I put this story in, Drew, was because it came from the Wall Street Journal. The article itself is pretty thin on details. I don't know if you noticed. What they said is they think that there might be, someone said that there's a trade blacklist being prepared by the Chinese government. And then the article went on to say Cisco would be affected without any proof that they're on the list. Did you read that?
I don't have access to the Wall Street Journal, so I did not read it.
No, well, I had to hunt around to find a copy of it off site. But it... the reason I say that is because I really just want to exploit the fact that there was a mention that there's a blacklist that may or may not be happening. And if it is a blacklist, then Cisco might be on it. And then the article goes straight off into what the impacts would be for Cisco. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think it. I'm more on the line of some of the research which said I don't think it'll have an impact to Cisco so much because their exposure to China is already pretty small. They've been walking back out of China for several years now. They really never got much traction there and have struggled. They've been strongly identified with the US government, of course, gone head-to-head with Huawei. They had the court case with Huawei back in the day where they accused Huawei of stealing their proprietary or their intellectual property. And I would imagine that Cisco's got very little business left there except for a few companies who might be buying their product. So I doubt it has much impact at the end of the day.
Yeah, so apparently if this blacklist does exist, it's still in a draft form, and it, to me, reads as a political move by China saying, well, you block Huawei, then we block Cisco, your local champion. It's just sort of politics. I found an article from Motley Fool that said Cisco generates less than 3% of its revenue in China, and its share in China has been shrinking for many years, so if this does actually happen, it's not going to be a crippling blow for Cisco in any way.
Yeah, it's a good point, though, in that it is true that Cisco lost the Chinese market when they took on Huawei and upset the Chinese, you know, upset that whole apple cart there. Now, whether they chose to do that, knowing that that's what would happen, or whether that was the right thing to do, the point is that they don't have a footprint in the Chinese market, and probably as a result of that, probably at the end of the day, hasn't, you know, in the current political environment, has probably done them a service. They're not suddenly looking at, hey, 20% of my revenue just suddenly disappeared. You know? So who knows? These accidents do happen, you know, the happy little accidents.
Absolutely happy little accidents. And not to mention that the other political side of this, where if you're selling equipment to an authoritarian government that's doing terrible things to people, that doesn't look good for you as an American company. So,
is that the U.S. government you're talking about or the Chinese government?
Zing.
Zing. Yeah.
Take your pick,
yeah,
folks.
I mean, just here in the U.K., I'm seeing press releases of pretty grim things coming out of the U.S. at the same time as I'm seeing them come out from China. And so sometimes I'm just got to be a little careful. Yeah, I agree.
Duly noted. Duly noted. One more thing from the Motley Fool story. Starting back in 2012, China stopped allowing Cisco to bid for Chinese government contracts. So that decline has been going on for almost a decade now. So
yeah.
As we said, not a significant blow to Cisco if this blacklist does emerge as true.
But again, the reporting on this is pretty dodgy. And literally, there was no... Anyway, so there you go.
A source of a source of a source, yeah. All right, the Russian government plans to update its laws to block the use of security-oriented protocols such as TLS 1.3, DNS over HTTPS, and encrypted server name identifiers. These protocols make it easier to encrypt DNS queries and hide website destinations from official snoopers, and I guess Russia wants to block that.
Yeah, you'll remember 4 to 6 weeks ago we talked about that China was also moving to block TLS 1.3. Because it actually not only does it encrypt the data, it also encrypts the site that you're going to, so the domain name that you're actually looking up. And I think I indicated at the time that, you know, China does not want to lose control over that. It's gone to a great deal of trouble to keep its internet separate from the rest of the world. And the Russian government is now moving to do the same thing. This article points out that they're actually from Caitlin Campanu, says they're looking to block TLS 1.3, DNS over HTTPS, both of which use encrypted server name identifiers. So you don't see the server name, only the IP address goes in the request. So it is a bit of a thing where you want to have that happening. And it's that another step down that path to balkanization of the internet. We've talked about that, where it seems like, you know, the US is moving to close down its internet access, you know, small steps first by moving China Telecom out. But I think that the current administration will probably continue to take steps down that path to isolate the US internet to some extent. Who knows how far? We've seen the EU start to make discussions and saying, how do we protect our internet from foreign adversaries? And that nearly always means some sort of, you know, perimeter around the system. And then, of course, Russia and China are now looking to basically block traffic. That means that they can't get visibility. And that is a thing. The IETF has a policy to create encrypted and private protocols. And unfortunately, I would suggest that they've taken far too long to get this passed. They need to be moving with a great deal more purpose. If they want to be a part out of these issues, they have to hustle. And this is too late. The governments can now get up, block it before they get on the ground. If we had have had critical mass now, they couldn't block it because it would have been done. So disappointing.
Right.
An opportunity missed because the IETF is too slow.
Yeah, I agree. We're seeing a fracturing of the internet, and it seems like it's just accelerating. All right, two stories to go before we wrap. First, Cisco has gazed into its pandemic crystal ball, and it's sending save-the-date invites for a Cisco Live in Australia in December 2021. Register reporter Simon Sharwood got an invite for a live in-person event for the APJC region hosted in Melbourne, live and in-person. So Cisco making a bet that by December 2021, folks will be willing to get on a plane and go somewhere in person.
Yeah. Just a pro tip there, it's Melbourne. Not Melbourne. Melbourne.
Thank you.
That's how it's spelled.
Touche. Berkeley. Melbourne. Melbourne.
The first thing about this is that it is in Australia where the COVID situation is somewhat managed and under control. They're talking very small numbers of COVID infections and very small numbers of COVID deaths. I believe currently they're announcing one COVID infection per day at this point in time across the entire country of 26-odd million people. So definitely, there's reason to be bullish about Australia. It just baffles me that vendors continue to feel that physical events are important. We live in an internet world. We're all on the internet. I don't understand why conferences are needed. And the vendors are absolutely adamant that these things have to happen ASAP. We cannot possibly wait. You know, we can't just not do them. And, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
I've been through several virtual events now. I think most of us probably have. And while, yes, I can still get information, there is something sort of flaccid feeling about them. They lack the pizzazz, the pop, and frankly, the friction you get from interacting with other humans in real life. So there is, I think, something to that. So I understand the sense of wanting to push, but I feel like it is way too early to start talking about live events.
Yeah, I don't think the end of 2021... You know, or the, you know, December 2021, maybe. I suspect that the, you know, all the evidence points to early vaccines will be available mid-2021 in small, limited numbers. And then, you know, there'll be widespread vaccinations towards the end of 2021. Will that be enough to hold a live event? Well, you know, I don't understand why we can't just say, like, dunno. Let's just can them for now, put the budget, the marketing budget back in our pockets, and we'll get started when it's clear that things are going. But apparently not. I mean, I love a conference. It's a great boondoggle, and I know for a lot of people it's a week off work, and the company yes. ships you, and you know, you can have a lot of fun and all that sort of stuff. But really, is it necessary? I'd love to hear people's FU on the matter. Actually, why don't you send me some FU, packetpushers.net/FU. Give me a follow-up. Are conferences good or bad? Are they essential? Nice to have? Could you live without them? Have you ever been to one? Do you want to go to one if you haven't? Will the world, you know, will you struggle for information if you didn't get to a conference? I don't know. Tell me. I'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, a couple more points from me. I think if we are going to see live events come back, it's not going to be in the United States. It's going to have to be in Europe or some places like Melbourne, Australia, where they've got a better handle on the virus. Melbourne. Maybe we should all just go to New Zealand for a conference. They seem to have their act together.
Yeah, they wouldn't let you in. Yeah, but yeah.
They wouldn't let me in, that's right. Never mind. So I also wonder then if we're going to start to see hybrid events where it's live for a small number of folks, but also presented virtually for everybody else just because of this disparity between where folks can go and where they can't.
I think the challenge here is most of our virtual events haven't innovated enough. They're just using video conferencing to emulate the conference experience. So talking head, all right, well, that talking head must be on stage. They're really not finding that the magic, I think. I think they're really not working it out. That's what I think.
I agree. There are opportunities to get really creative. Mm. Yeah, to get really creative with a virtual event.
I have a whole bunch of ideas about how I would do it. But and it certainly wouldn't involve a once-a-year event. It would be something that I would do every week.
Huh.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't. I think this idea of having a big constipation, you know, saving it all up and then opening wide and letting it all flow out on a given date is a bit 1989, really. I think you need to.
Don't really appreciate that metaphor, but okay.
I like to create a visual image that's got a visceral appeal.
Event planners, if you've got some consulting dough in your budget, maybe give Greg a ring. All right, our last story, it's our surfing dog story, a charming story from Wales about an 18-month-long mystery when at 7 a.m. each morning, local broadband services would fail for everyone in the village. After a year and a half of investigation and eventually some mucking about with a spectrum analyzer, the culprit turned out to be an old television that the owner switched on each morning that apparently generated a signal that disrupted internet for everybody else.
Isn't that brilliant? There's a couple of
great... That's great.
First of all, there's certain countries where the ISPs would certainly not stick with something for 18 months to work it out. Because this village has...
True.
I want to say that the article talks about the village having about 18 houses in it. So this is not 500 or 1,000 people. This is like, you know, 40 or 50 people. And apparently every morning at 7 o'clock exactly, the internet, the broadband would just go out, like, completely. And it was an old television that would literally issue leak into the spectrum. I've got an idea that this is an old black and white TV. They're actually somewhat popular in a certain demographic here in the UK because if you own a black and white TV, you don't have to pay a television license to watch the national television.
Yes, to watch okay.
The and So sometimes people still have them and, you know, and those old TVs still work quite often. Mm-hmm. When all else has failed, a lot of these are still working. So you say what you like, but yeah, if it's not broken, don't fix it, as they say.
For sure, and clearly this wasn't broken and didn't need fixing, except that it disrupted
the
internet for everyone
BBC
else.
The article is full of typical Englishness, like, I was so pleased, you know, just 2 years of continuing to work on it and coming back to it. And, you know, like, and I could just imagine going around interviewing all the people in the village going like, it was so frustrating, it never worked. And whiny, whiny, complainy, plainy, but there you go.
I do take your point, though, that it's amazing that an ISP would persist that long in solving a problem, because that wouldn't happen here in the United States.
You know, I wanna ask if anybody who was doing the complaining was like a senior exec or somebody's mum or dad was.
Maybe they had a vacation cottage.
Yeah, a vacation cottage of a senior exec from the telco or something. I mean, you never know, do you? You just don't know.
You never know.
But I'm so cynical that I think ugly thoughts like that. I'm very sad.
You've just ruined our pleasant ending. Yes.
There you go.
All right. Well, stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation on PMPD Actress deployment of Fortinet's SD-WAN. That's coming right up. You're listening to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute conversation approximately at the intersection of technology and business. Our focus today is a real-world SDN deployment, and we're talking with John Tabacco. He is Director of IT Infrastructure for PM Pediatrics, a healthcare provider with offices across the United States. PM Pediatrics is a Fortinet customer, and Fortinet is our sponsor for this show. So, John, welcome to the program. Can you tell us briefly about PM Pediatrics?
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. PM Pediatrics is the nation's largest urgent care for pediatrics, children up to age 26. We are all across the nation, and we're typically on Main Street USA in a small brick-and-mortar type location.
Okay, so the idea is if folks have some kind of emergency, they can just sort of walk in and get treatment for their kids.
Absolutely. We're open noon to midnight every day in most major cities, and currently 60 locations. And we're hoping to get to 100 over the next year or so.
Okay, so a lot of locations, a lot of connectivity needs, I'm sure. What drove you to SD-WAN generally and then Fortinet's secure SD-WAN solution specifically?
The locations that existed when I came on board back in 2018 were Cisco 1900 routers and a Netgear switch, which really wouldn't cut it for modern day security and protecting resources inside. So adding a high cost circuit would definitely be my first choice, because that's what I've done before. But in this case, I was pretty excited to keep the broadband and try and get two broadbands and go with an SD-WAN solution, which I thought was a perfect fit for us.
Yeah, because that would get you a lot more bandwidth over the old 1900 solution as well. Plus, and just more bandwidth solves all problems for capacity, I think.
And the rate that we're growing, it's easier to deploy as well. I can have these things pre-configured. I can send them out. We use remote hands, get these things up and running real quick. I'm not waiting for circuits to be installed, for the router guy to come, take his coffee break, you know, the whole old world mentality of telecom.
Yeah, just getting standard off-the-shelf broadband internet connections it turns up in a few days or a few, you know, maybe a week or two. Whereas the old MPLS would be like provision checks and blah, 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 you know, then something would be wrong and it'd have to reprovision and it could be months before you got it in. So just a saving right there for growth in the business.
Absolutely.
I'm also guessing with 60 locations or 60 plus, you don't have people, IT people on site at every location. So having something you can just essentially direct someone to walk through to plugging it in is probably better for you.
Exactly. We're centralized in the sense that our corporate location is in Long Island, New York. And we use remote hand services all across the country. Different states, we have different people that we go to help us out. Mm-hmm. And for the last 2 years, it's been working out real great.
So you hinted at something there a minute ago, that you were pre-provisioning the Fortinet SD-WAN devices. Does that mean they're being pre-provisioned at the factory and then just shipping directly to site?
We're trying to get to that point. That's a very exciting proposition there. I might take you up on that. But what we are doing is using FortiManager. And FortiManager is centralized in our data center. And through the public IP that the device gets at the location, it communicates back to FortiManager, encrypted and secure. And configurations can be standardized across the board. I can push the same policy all across the nation.
That policy is a real security fence. We'll talk about that more down the line a little bit. But that's sure. So it's that you take the box out on site, you plug it in, it registers, calls home to the Fortinet SD manager, and then it knows where the device is and it's ready to go basically minutes later, sort of thing.
Exactly. There's a template that we have for the locations, and that's what we apply. And now we're standard across the board. Maybe it's a crazy thing, but us network guys like to do things the same. over and over and over and over again. So that when we support it, we know exactly what's happening.
So what are the key applications that you have to support over the WAN?
Well, voice is a big one. So the incoming number for those locations are local numbers to the state that we're in. So voice is a big, big concern. We want to be able to answer that phone for somebody who's in an urgent care type situation. We have an EMR, electronic medical record application.
Yeah.
That's also hosted in the cloud. There's a common theme here. It's all cloud. Our email is cloud as well. We try to, I don't want servers to fail that will cause issues across the nation. A lot of people think it's risky, but I believe it's getting to a point where it's much more mature than the early days. And the Microsoft platform combined with the Fortinet platform makes me feel real, real confident in the solutions that we've chosen.
Okay. So you're talking about UCaaS for your voice?
Yes. We use a centralized cloud. It's RingCentral. They are omnipresent, I guess. If you're in California, I don't know how that automagic works in the cloud and the RingCentral design. But for me, because of the Fortinet and the way the policy can be pushed to those devices, internet is going out locally, right? Which I think is a big deal. Because if you're doing location type services, when you go to Google or whatever type of search that you're doing, you don't want to funnel all your traffic from all these locations into a data center and then out to the internet.
Right.
A lot of the SD-WAN solutions I've worked with in the past, that's exactly what they would do. They would VPN or encrypt the traffic all inclusively back to a centralized data center and then out to the internet from there. And when you're nationwide, if I'm in California and I go to check the weather and it's showing me Secaucus, New Jersey's temperature, that's not going to work.
Well, it's also because a lot of the SaaS services actually have POPs all over the country or all over the world. Yes. And you don't want to be trunking your traffic from, the left side of some country to the right side just to access that. You want to be using their POPs. They've already put that infrastructure in place. So it makes sense to break out as quickly as possible.
So that was the big win or big draw for me, or one of anyway.
But it's always a security issue then, because you're actually sort of, once you break out locally, you're using some visibility and control. But you said before that you have a standard policy. What about visibility? You're getting visibility from the solution?
Absolutely. I can see everything that everyone's doing at all times. The FortiManager is tied in with something called FortiAnalyzer. Mm-hmm. And all the devices out across the nation sync their logs up to FortiAnalyzer. Now, it's important to realize that when I push the policy out to that firewall, it's dumping the traffic locally, but the firewall policy is acting locally. So the same security policy I have in California is the same in Chicago, is the same in New York. Uniform across the board.
Without having to backhaul it back to a central location either.
Yes. And when you're doing voice and critical things like that, you don't really want to do that, especially high load.
Yeah, what normally happens is the router config in location A gets different from the one in B and one in C, and somebody doesn't clean up the rules, and then once they're changed, you can't make the change because you don't know, you might break it, and this whole one policy everywhere dramatically changes your security policy in real life, I think.
Yes. I mean, you do have to, in the way that we treat it because of the changes that we made universally back in starting in 2018, we allow the same things at every location.
And the other side of this too is that a lot of those policy rules are actually application aware. They're not IP address this, IP address that. It's application this, application that.
Absolutely. That's another key attraction to the Fortinet product. It is application aware. So in healthcare, we have things that we have to protect patient information. So we want to allow things like Dropbox or Google Drive or any of the public type infrastructure, just because we don't want data from inside leaking into those mechanisms, right? So the Fortinet allows me to do that, and it allows me to do that standardized across the country.
So you mentioned voice as a critical application. You also mentioned not being on a regular circuit, like an MPLS circuit. So a lot of folks shy away from that because they worry, if I'm just putting my voice traffic across a public internet connection, maybe the experience isn't going to be so great. What has your experience been like, or your end user experience been like, running voice over SD-WAN and the public internet?
So I've had the fortunate experience of trying it two ways. Before we went to the cloud service, we tried.
Is that what you call it?
Yeah. Using the NEC product that we had, which worked out pretty well, We just had some vendor issues. We were good in New York, but as we moved east, the support thinned out. And a lot of problems with things that shouldn't be. So while the voice quality through the SD-WAN over the internet, through an SBC in our data center, worked flawlessly. We had a relationship with bandwidth.com, and we accepted 200 to 500 trunks from that service. It worked great, but feature-wise and analytic-wise and all these other things that are important to large organizations wasn't really there. And to get that level of expertise, I would say, required a lot more than we could get from our current vendor.
So this is the old NEC sort of key systems where there's like 16, 32 handsets in a system, and they've got this arcane programming language and these custom interfaces. And most of those people sort of don't actually know how to spell IP.
They do not. And they're either afraid of it or they just don't want to use it. And when your support guy types in *67245 on a phone and you don't know what that does, it's actually triggering something in the local PBX. I need to be able to support over 100 locations with a small staff. Cost is always a factor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Moving it to the cloud was the best thing we could have done.
Yeah, well, I think it's not just cost, it's simplicity. You know where you're at. And that actually ends up saving you money. Cost isn't the reason that when we prepped for this call, you didn't say I needed to save money. What you said was I just need to do it better. And that's what you've ended up with here, is by kicking out the NECs and replacing it with a SaaS service. The voice calls didn't change much, but you've got visibility and you've got a lot less complexity.
Absolutely.
So what about impact on day-to-day operations? Does having SD-WAN in place make any difference for things like, well, we mentioned visibility. What about troubleshooting, change management, that kind of thing?
So we use remote access software that flows through the SD-WAN to get to the locations. So if somebody does have an issue at a PC, one of my support team can remote into that device and view the same desktop that the person is using. And we actually extended that to our application support people. So people having issues with the EMR, they can get help. And that remote desktop can be viewed pretty much anywhere securely. And we know who's doing it. Across the country. And the feedback from that has been fantastic.
How so? Like whose feedback has been good? Is it the administrators or the end users?
Well, the end users for the most part, because they are calling about a problem and trying to describe it over the phone. But when we say, let me remote in and take a look at what you're doing, their initial shock goes to joy when we show them how
I mean, the key here is that you're doing the remote access over the SD-WAN. You're not coming over the internet via a back door or something, which is insecure. You're actually connected to the SD-WAN, and then you're right there on their desktop taking control. And you've got and because of the way SD-WAN works, more bandwidth, and it's load balanced, and it's cost, you're actually getting real-time response. You're not sort of... Yeah, it's a combination of this. Yeah.
If I didn't tell you, and I had a support person come in here and I gave them the private IP of the device in California, they wouldn't know the difference. They would they would have thought we had private circuits or MPLS or any of the various things. It's really robust and it's high performance. I have no regrets.
But you're also running through an encrypted tunnel, which is important because you're dealing with sensitive information.
In many ways, that's a very key point. I think that's even better than the older circuits and even the MPLS. A lot of that was unencrypted. So our data was traveling across those older platforms, in a VLAN on a carrier switch, which if somebody went in the same VLAN, they could see our traffic. Uh-huh. Now that's not possible.
Yeah, I've been trying to tell people that for years, but they refuse to acknowledge that. One last question that I wanted to ask you. You've got a roadmap about moving into the cloud. How is your Fortinet SD-WAN looking for getting onto the cloud platforms?
So the first thing I did when I got on board was build the data center that I could stick the Fortinet in and build my SD-WAN core. And as we move west and build more sites out there, I know there's going to be a need for a second data center. Our initial plans, because our voice core was in one data center, we wanted to duplicate that core in the second one. I soon realized that I don't really need that second data center. I can use Azure. And the exciting thing about it is the SD-WAN that I have in place today, I can add interfaces at each location in every state that rides the Microsoft network. So, and then goes back through into Azure through that location, where I have in Azure two virtual Fortinet appliances that are the receiving end of those tunnels as well. So in effect, if I lose my main data center, I've got VMs running in Azure that are domain controllers. I have our DFS sitting up there as well, which is a backup copy of the one in the data center. So in essence, I have created that second data center using Azure. And in many ways, I feel a better solution than the second data center.
So this is taking advantage of Azure's VWAN integration. So the Fortinet SD-WAN integrates directly with the VWAN feature that they've brought on recently.
Absolutely.
Right.
And some of the side effects, if you want to call it that, that we've noticed, which I think is pretty cool. Yeah. There's I'll talk about the Microsoft side effect, and then I'll talk about the InterNAP side effect. But the Microsoft side effect was that we've noticed traffic preferring to go over the Microsoft VWAN connections on the Fortinet through the Microsoft national network back to our VMs in the Azure portal. It's choosing that as a better path than the broadband internet peering to however it gets to our data center.
Right, because Microsoft has built out this optimized backbone for themselves.
So here we are able to leverage that for it's like having a national carrier.
Right.
along with the services that Azure provides. Very exciting stuff.
And for a business like yours, that is uniquely a feature that you could never get unless you were a much larger company. You're literally getting features and functions that would normally be for a much larger organization to be able to access, I think.
Absolutely. And coming from those organizations and knowing what we want and to see this available through Azure, it's going to transform the landscape.
Hmm. John, I guess one final issue I wanted to ask you, because ultimately you're a healthcare provider and COVID must have had an impact on the business. Did that change your Fortinet SD-WAN implementation in any way?
I was very confident in having it because we got hit traffic in multiple ways, right? Okay. People that were normally in the corporate office are now working from home and they needed to access resources on the network. So there were more remote users than ever before. We had more Zoom meetings, which was, you know, basically 16, 20, 25 people on a Zoom call, video and audio, no care in the world for the poor network guy that has to make sure all this stuff works. So they would max out, you know, HD or 4K video across the network. Our EMR had to keep working and our voice calls. The amount of people that came in for testing for their children and for their family and first responders, which we offered to do, which is something for pediatrics that would never be done. We wanted to make sure that we were helping our communities. There was never one instance where we had an internet outage related to firewalls or what the Fortinet product was doing. There were some local outages with carriers. We lost our WAN 1 connection, but because the Fortinet has that good old WAN 2 on the interfaces, the traffic seamlessly switched over to WAN 2 and ran from there, unnoticeable to the crew at large.
And then it was only you had to run around and fix it, but you weren't too panicked because it was still working. Yeah,
I'd say I was a little concerned, but not panicked. Never, guys never panic.
Well, that does wrap it up. If folks are interested in learning more about Fortinet, they can just head on over to Fortinet.com. That's Fortinet.com. John, thank you for joining us, and thanks to Fortinet for being a sponsor. Sponsors make it possible for us to produce a whole slate of nerdy IT podcasts. Speaking of which, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter. That's at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.